Blog Talk Radio.
I've seen strangers raising flags, seen you dressed in ashen rags, seen them all turn around. Just like you, I hold my ground, but I stand quiet, I stand still, like a rock throughout the ages. I'm just a stone from your home. I'm Jerusalem's stone. And I've waited all this time to see you in this land of mine. And I've waited through the ugliness and grime
to see you in this land of mine.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Whoa, whoa, it's time to start the show. Blessings and greetings, greetings and blessings, blessed souls. We're live because we want to stay alive with the blessing of the Most High Creator's blessings in Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachamim, instructions of mercy. You're now tuned to blogtalkradio.com, and we humbly suggest we are the higher inner frequency of Blog Talk Radio. We call ourselves Soul Class. This is Soul Class 540, heart to heart from Jerusalem to the rest of the world program, presentation number 49. Blessed is our Creator. Shalom, peace, and bracha, blessing upon the human family experience. With the Creator's help, we're broadcasting right now live, 5:32, Holy Land, Jerusalem, Israel time, corresponding to 10:32 Eastern Standard Time, live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA Unifying Souls. Actually, program content will focus on being in discussion with international human rights activist Rabbi Dr. Eliezer Goldstock. Our call-in number to listen in will be 347, or actually is 347-838-8669. And also, I want to remind you to check out the wonderful international website, which soon will be receiving an upgrade. But while it's still here in the cyberspace, it's still good unto itself, www.hearttoheartamerican.org/Jerusalem.html. Meanwhile, may the Eternal Creator bless and protect you and your loved ones peacefully and pleasantly. See how smoothly I can speak with those when I juice up on beets and carrots before the show? Which way did he go, Wabbit? Okay, we're going to turn on the music from Eighth Day, from the Marcus Brothers. Thank you very much, Marcus Brothers. And that's from their wonderful new CD, Inner Flame. There's no shame to reveal your inner flame. And joining me right now is international human rights activist, Rabbi Dr. Eliezer Goldstock. Good afternoon, R-D-E-G.
Well, good afternoon, Rev. Don Zusha Goodman, D-Z-G, R-D-Z-G. And I want to say, first of all, thank you very much for having me. I want to tell you that the weather here in Yerushalayim has been very mild. I don't know if you remember, there was a commercial, a cigarette commercial for Chesterfield cigarettes when I was a kid. I think it said outstanding and they're mild. No, I think that was a different cigarette. Anyhow, whatever.
For my time.
They were outstanding and they were mild. I want to tell you, in those days, none of those cigarettes had filters on them.
Oh, boy.
Imagine what we're talking about. Oh, my gosh. I saw recently a video clip of a movie, of an old movie, where the husband and wife come in to consult with the doctor, and the doctor sits down and picks up his cigarettes and offers the husband and wife a cigarette, and they take one, and he lights their cigarette, and he lights his, and he leans back, and they have a consultation in the doctor's office. And I'm thinking to myself, my gosh, have we come that far? Yeah, we have, you know. It's amazing.
True.
Anyhow,
Yes, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No. Continue your thought.
No, it's your program. I'm just the guest host.
It's our problem. We're both guests of a Kodesh Baruch Hu in this blessed world, Eliezer, but I figure we'll start with a little.
And that reminds me of a story. No.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Let's start off with a little word, Devar Malchus, word from the king. This is a letter I found in the famous Frankel Shul yesterday. And I actually, it's very interesting, they translated it to English. Because when I went to the Igros Kodesh, the holy letters of the Rebbe from the seventh volume, I couldn't find the letter. So perhaps because it was a general letter, it's not printed in the normal Igros, but I felt so compelled to share this because it deals with the upcoming holiday, which I know you're going to elaborate upon, which is Yutes Kislev, the Day of Liberation, the founder of Chabad Hasidus, Rabbi Shneur Zalman Liadi. And as well, the Rebbe mentioned twice about the idea of handicaps. Now, you talk about handicapable people, and yet every human being born upon the face of the earth since the original sin, as they call it, the sin the sin of the tree of good and evil. We've all been handicapped with mortality.
But even that gave us the handicap of mortality.
Right. So the Rebbe gets into a little more microcosmic type of handicap that everyone almost has to deal with. But let me just read the letter, and I'm looking forward to your comments upon this, just as you commented on the letter the teaching that I mentioned last week. This is from 62 plus years ago, the 10th of Kislev, which is also a Hasidic holiday, the day of liberation of his son, the Mitla Rebbe, the Alter Rebbe's son. Greetings and blessing to my brethren everywhere. God bless you all. In connection with the Day of Liberation, the 19th of Kislev, of the founder of Chabad, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, author of the Tanya, who is released from imprisonment for the dissemination of Chabad, established freedom of thought and practice for the ideology and the way of life of Chabad Hasidim in particular, and of general Hasidism as a whole. I wish to express herewith my inner wish that every one of us be liberated with God's help and by determined personal effort, and there's the first mentioned word handicap, from all handicaps which arrest the good and noble in everyone's nature. So this is a part of one's nature, this part of one's nature reigns supreme, giving fullest expression to the threefold love, love of our people, Israel, love of our Torah, and love of God, which are all one. Our sages said that each and every soul was in the presence of his divine majesty before coming down to this earth, and that the souls were hewn from under the seat of glory. These sayings emphasize the essential nature of the soul, its holiness and purity, and its being completely divorced from anything material and physical. The soul itself, by its very nature, is not subject to any material desires or temptations, which arise only from the physical body and the quote-unquote animal soul. Nevertheless, it was the Creator's will that the soul, which is truly a part of the divine above, should descend into the physical and coarse world and be confined within and united with a physical body for scores of years in a state which is absolutely repulsive to its very nature. All this for the purpose of a divine mission, which the soul has to fulfill to purify and spiritualize the physical body and the related physical environment by permeating them with the light of God, so as to make this world an abode for the Shekhinah, the divine presence. This can only be done through a life of torn mitzvahs. When the soul fulfills this mission, all the transient pain and suffering connected with the soul's descent and life on this earth are not only justified, but infinitely outweighed by the great reward and everlasting bliss which the soul enjoys thereafter. From the above, one can easily appreciate the extent of the tragedy of disregarding the soul's mission on earth. For in doing so, one condemns the soul to a term of useless suffering not compensated for, nor nullified by that everlasting happiness which God has intended for it. Even when there are brief moments of a religious activity in the study of the Torah and the practice of the mitzvahs, it is sad to contemplate how often such activity is tinted by the lack of real enthusiasm and inner joy, not realizing that these activities which justify existence. Aside from missing the vital point through failure of taking advantage of the opportunity to fulfill God's will, thus forfeiting the everlasting benefits to be derived therefrom, it is contrary to sound reason to choose that side of life which accentuates the enslavement and degradation of the soul, or rejecting the good that is inherent in it, namely the great ascent that is to come from the soul's descent. It will now become eminently clear what our sages meant when they said, "No man commits a sin unless he was stricken with temporary insanity." No profound thinking is required to realize that life is compulsory, and since the soul, which is a part of the divine above, is compelled to descend into a frame of dust and ashes, the proper thing to do is to make the most of the soul's sojourn on earth. Only in life, in which every aspect is permeated by the Torah and the mitzvahs, makes this possible. Therefore, it is abundantly clear that since God, who is the essence of goodness, compels the soul to descend from its sublime heights to the lowest depths, for the purpose of the study of the Torah and the fulfillment of the mitzvahs, how great is the Torah and mitzvahs. Furthermore, the descent of the soul for the purpose of ascent shows there is no other way to obtain that objective except through the soul's descent to live on this earth. If there was an easier way, God would not compel a soul to descend from the sublime heights of the seat of glory down to this nether world, the lowest of all worlds. For only here, in the lowest depths, can the soul attain its highest descent, higher even than the angels, and as our sages say, the righteous precede the foremost angels. Reflecting upon the greatness of the Torah and mitzvahs specifically pertaining to this life, reflecting also that Torah and mitzvahs are the only means to attain the soul's perfection and the fulfillment of the divine purpose, one will experience a real joy at his fate and destiny despite the many difficulties and, second mention, and handicaps from within and without, which are inevitable on this earth. Only in this way can one live out up to the injunction, serve God with joy, which the Baal Shem Tov made one of the foundations of his teachings, and was expounding at length in Chabad, and pointed out by its founder, whose liberation we commemorate on the 19th of Kislev, in his monumental work, the Tanya, and the Rebbe referenced, see chapters 26 and chapter 31. With blessing from the Rebbe. I just want to mention, Elias, before you comment and elucidate, I feel this letter by the Rebbe encapsulates your life's work. So many times you've struck upon these points, but more than that, here the Rebbe is bringing out the microcosmic perception and Torah perception of handicap. It's not just someone who might be lacking in speech or lacking the use of a leg or might be lacking at some level of their cognitive development at a certain stage in life. It's everything that all of us have to deal with. And the fact that with that, to serve God with joy and to bring out the point that we have to actualize the potential of every human soul living upon the face of this earth. So I'm using that as sort of like the umbrella mission statement above your personal mission statement within Heart to Heart, and I'll let you take it away and elucidate on the matters you feel you think need further elaboration.
Yes, it's. I agree that... You know, what's funny is that as you were reading that, it came to me that what we're talking about really is degrees. If we're going to say that every single person that is born into this world has a, first of all, as the Rebbe points out, the chelek elokai mamam, a soul, a neshama. But more importantly, everybody has what everyone else has. In other words, no one is born into this world uniquely independent or absent some form of a disability. So, as the Rebbe points out, that the Eitz Hadas brought us to the Darga of mortality, which is a handicap because we were originally put into this world to live forever. But we all have some form of a disability. It's degrees that we're talking about. At what point does your disability or the degree of your disability require someone else to support or possibly involve themselves in your life to give you assistance? Now, there are many people who are functioning perfectly well without any assistance at all, and some who are getting a lot of assistance and we don't even realize it. certainly, a person with a hearing disability who wears a hearing aid has received the support and assistance that they need, and perhaps if you don't see the hearing aid and the prosthetic is properly hidden away, and in a clandestine way that nobody sees it. So that person is walking around with a disability that nobody's aware of. A person who is confined to a wheelchair, certainly that disability is much more visible. And I was just thinking about, you know, the prosthetics that are available today for amputees, you know, because of the military application. We see people that are walking and running who wear long pants. You don't even realize, but their legs are, you know, but their legs are gone, and yet they have this prosthesis that allows them or affords them the ability to ambulate and to be completely mobile. Now, we're talking about a specific population that suddenly becomes a focus of our attention, because the disabilities are much more obvious and more blatant. When we left Gan Eden, and were pushed out because of the Eitz Hadas, the tree of knowledge of good and evil in this world, and we became very knowledgeable of the mundane and the profane of life, so we became aware of our bodies, we became aware of sin, we became aware of a lot. Now, I always like to come back to, and it's very important, that when the Jewish people stood at Har Sinai, was the first time that we were once again back to the level of Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. All the people witnessed the thunder and the lightning and the sound of the horns, and the mountain was smoking. And when the people saw it, they fell backwards and stood at a distance. And Moshe says to Hashem, he says, "You speak to us, and we will obey. Nasa'ev and Nishma. But allow not for Hashem to speak to us, or we'll die." So this is a very interesting thing. These psukim clearly describe something that took place, but describe something that took place. Not only clearly describe something that took place, but what exactly was it that took place? And that's the question. There was a seeing and a hearing, but what exactly was it that was seen, and what was it that was heard?
Mm-hmm.
And how did it all happen?
Mm-hmm.
Rabbi Akiva explains that that they saw, what they saw was what they heard.
Mm-hmm.
And they heard what was seen. A little confusing. Follow that. They saw what was heard, and they heard what was seen. There's another view that states that the people heard what was audible, and they saw what was visible. But according to this second view, this Rabbi Yishmael, the handicapped amongst the Jewish people who stood at the mountain at Har Sinai experienced the revelation of Har Sinai within the limits of their disabilities and within
Wow.
the constraints, within the constraints of nature as we know it. Imagine?
Wow. These
are Torah scholars that are explaining something that, you know, the profession is having a difficult time understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So the blind could only hear what was spoken, but not experience what was seen. And the deaf were only able to see that portion of the revelation that was visible. However, due to their handicap, they were denied the accessibility to that aspect of the audible nature of the revelation. So, as a result of the second opinion, only the fully abled, normal, and typical could benefit from the full entire experience of Har Sinai. Isn't that it? So, when I'm saying to you, when I'm talking about or answering your question or making a comment here, we're talking about degrees. You know, everything is in the level of degrees. Rabbi Akiva, however, offers to us that the limits of the handicap were not an obstacle to fully witnessing and experiencing the complete revelation to RC9. You hear this? This is after Rabbi Yishmael comes and, you know, slugs us up. Now Rabbi Akiva comes back and he says, look, what Rabbi Akiva is positing here is that every Jew standing at the foot of the mountain was there at that moment without any limit or obstacle to their ability to receive the Torah. Yeah? No obstacle to receiving the Torah. So that puts us back on the level of before eating from the Eitz HaDaas, right?
Right.
It's important to note that no place does anyone say or imply that these handicapped and that these handicapped and disabled amongst the Jewish people were cured or healed. What is, however, inferred is that these individual disadvantages, you know, their limits and handicaps, were somehow overcome in order that everyone could see, hear, and understand. Yeah? Amazing, right? So according to the second opinion, Rabbi Yishmael, the seeing and the hearing at Har Sinai was simply stated as usual. It was a usual hearing, a normal seeing, rather than something that was miraculous on a level of audio visual, you know, some kind of atypical dissonance, right? So Rabbi Akiva's view is that there was a specifically different quality to the sights and sounds of the synaptic experience.
Eliezer, can I just interject? Can I interject? When you say usual, can we substitute the word that it was under natural circumstances or like alpiteva? And if it is so, then again, we as human beings are underestimating.
I think that's what the argument is. I'm not sure. Right. I suppose you could, but I think that's what Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Akiva are both agreeing on. That it wasn't. Right. It may have been. I think that's exactly the disagreement or the agreement, is that there is a question about it being natural, usual, possibly. You know, some things that happen to us in a usual way or in an ordinary way. Look, there was a convergence of time and space that occurred, right? Beyond the norm,
right,
that transcended all the boundaries of, you know, of the ordinary. Thus, while not being cured, they were enabled to fully participate somehow, right?
Wow.
So
wow.
They were fully included. They were fully included. Now, I don't know if that's natural. I want to believe it is, but it seems like the way the codifiers of the Gemara are talking here is that they're explaining that it's usual. I don't think they use the word teva, natural. I don't remember that. I'll look it up and try to get back to you on that next week, but I don't remember ever seeing that. This is our goal as a society. Our goal as a society is to overcome all these limits and constraints, right?
Yes.
Our boundaries must transcend to a level of seeing and hearing to arrive at a completely new reality of acceptance and inclusion. In other words, usual, okay, but sometimes the unusual becomes the usual, right? So,
right.
And it's this hope and this awareness that will eventually lead us to the ultimate simcha, the ultimate oneness of, it's important that we understand, if a person has to daven, for example, okay, and he doesn't know which way is east, right? Because we have to daven facing east, unless you live where I do, right? In which case,
right.
You have to daven facing south.
Right.
But we won't get into that. Well, we can get into it. You face Yerushalayim.
Sure did.
So if you live north of Yerushalayim, you face south. Most of the people,
right.
Everybody in America faces east because that's where Yerushalayim is. But just because you don't know which direction is where Yerushalayim is, in which direction, does that mean you don't daven? You know? So let's say a person has some form of a disability, a cognitive disability of some form, right? And they can't make that determination as to which direction is east or south, you know, or north if they're, you know, living in South Africa, for example.
Right.
So do they still have to daven? Of course they do. But how do we know that? Because if you, who knows the difference between north and south, would find yourself in a airport late at night, time to daven Maariv, there's no sun out, and there's no one around to tell you which way is east, are you still obligated to daven Maariv, even though, and you still have to daven Shemoneh Esrei, even though you don't know if you're facing north, south, east, or west, right?
Mm-hmm.
You could be facing Northwest Airlines, and that could be east. You know what I mean? Okay.
Right.
So the point is that you're still obligated to daven, even though you don't know which direction to daven. Sure, you're going to ask, and you're going to try to find, but if there's no one around, you still have to daven.
Mm-hmm.
And you could daven in the wrong direction. So, I mean, mm-hmm. assuming that you're going to, of course, you're going to try to find the right direction. But the point is that if a person who has some form of a mental, physical disability is still obligated to daven, even though they don't know which direction they're supposed to daven.
That's right.
So, look, we have to eliminate the dependency on the society at large, and we have to start in instilling a sense of individual autonomy for everyone. It's a matter of degrees. If the disability that the person, the handicapability of the person, whatever it is, we have to begin with that, and we have to resist the fright and flight reaction that happens, you know, to parents. Which, you know, look, this is, there's a reaction that we as a society have towards people who have handicapabilities, who are differently abled. And that fosters a sense of inferiority and weakness.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in order to escape the prison of disabilities, we need to allow ourselves into their lives. And we have to look beyond the differences for their similarities. And where are the similarities? It's something called Tselem Elokim, which is the image of God.
That's
Man is created in the image of God. Well, does that mean God has arms and legs and a head? No, it doesn't. But it means that God had a vision of what a physical representation of godliness would be in this world, and he created us in that image. Not an exact copy, but a reflection of what Hashem wanted us to be able to confront the profane in this world, and to at the same time embrace the spiritual and the spiritual essence of life.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting, if not baffling, concept when we're talking about it specifically in the context of handicapability and differently able. Because if we're created in the image of Hashem, right, if we are indeed Tselem Elokim, and the person with a disability is also in the same mold, so where is the common denominator? I mean, So I just said it's a matter of degrees, right? So some of us have many degrees of distance from that ultimate model, and some of us are closer to Hashem in that physical model. But that doesn't mean that just because you're distanced in the physical model, the Goshmis model, that you're also equal distant from the essence model, the spiritual model, the Ruchnius mm-hmm. model, because it could be that the person who is further away physically may be closer spiritually. I mean, I'm not saying mm-hmm. that is 100% always the case, but it's certainly a possibility. Look, I met a fellow this week who we had a meeting with. He's confined to a wheelchair. Had a meeting. He and I didn't see eye to eye on anything in that meeting. Wasn't talking about disability, by the way. Had nothing to do with disability. It had to do with, we were talking about, concepts. And he and I didn't agree on a thing. And it, mm-hmm. and as far as I'm concerned, based on what he had to say, I don't see him any closer to Hashem based on what he said than a person who's, not confined to a wheelchair. In other words, it doesn't always go that just because a person has a physical disability, they're automatically closer to Hashem. You still have to be open to accept that. Now, the ability to accept that which is difficult to accept, it's the ability to be humble, whether it's imposed or demonstrated to us. In other words, you and I, Baruch Hashem, we're able to ambulate and walk around. Another person is confined to a wheelchair. Another person may have to, deal with other forms of assistance to get around. It's the ability to mark the milestones in our lives because that's what we're supposed to do. In other words, if I say to you, look, how do we make a distinction between a person who's differently abled in a greater degree than a lesser degree? Because we have milestones that we are constantly observing as a people. And one of the things that we would like to do is see to it that the people that we're dealing with are able to participate fully as members of the community by marking these milestones, collectively and individually, much the same way as everyone else, even though we may want to marginalize them. It's a matter of, I love to use the example of Torah being compared to water.
Mm-hmm.
Water is an element that always goes downward unless we attempt to contain it, and it'll explode. You can't contain water. And like water flows downward, covers everything in its path, it also fills all of the open places, cracks, crevices, yet water is a life-giving source, right? And this is Rabbi Akiva again. And he observed the effects of one steady drop of water over a long period of time on a stone, on a rock. And this dripping, this drop of one drop at a time of water was able to, over a long period of time, have an effect on the stone in that it wore a hole in the stone. You ever play the game rock, paper, scissors? So
not really.
We have, you did?
Nope.
You never played that game?
Nope.
All right.
Okay. Must be a generational thing.
It has nothing to do with what I'm about to say. I was just asking if you played the game. Okay, so anyhow, so look, over a period of time, this slow, methodical, and very concise activity made Rabbi Akiva realize that in order for Torah to have an effect on him, he would have to dedicate his life to studying Torah. In other words, for it to say have the same effect. So he began slowly but steadily to make a dent in the rock, so to speak. You know, if we look at ourselves as a rock, he was the age of 40 when he began to learn Torah.
Right.
You imagine what an amazing scholar he was, and he only started to learn at the age of 40. And there were so many, he had so many obstacles in his way. He sat on the roof of the study hall, the yeshiva, in the snow, and he looked through the skylight, and he was able to begin learning that way. So we see that, you know, water is a very good example. And Rabbi Akiva was the one who said that among, you know, five other things, four other things, one of the five things that you have to teach your child to do is swim.
Right.
And he realized, the reason was that he realized that the face of the world was covered fully by a significant amount of water, like 70% of the earth is water.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it have been easier to make a ruling that everyone should be careful of the water, you know, and avoid it? But this pitfall to avoidance would mean that each person would need to avoid successfully 70% of the face of the earth. So Rabbi Akiva realized that this could be an impossible task, given the nature of travel and migrations. In those days, it was either land or sea. We didn't have airplanes at the time, Rabbi Akiva. So the requirement to teach your child to swim is a ruling whose purpose is to teach our children how to properly confront the tides, roll, and the whirlpools and challenges of our lives, fully equipped to properly negotiate life's, you know, foreseen and unforeseen hazards and pitfalls. So it was a survival skill. So Rabbi Akiva was an amazing, amazing person, and what a tragic end to his life as well. But when we're confronted with a significant life challenge, as opposed to life's routine challenges, we always hope that we're properly equipped to negotiate these obstacles, right? Having a child born with a disability, Down syndrome or something else, is to most people a significant life challenge.
Mm-hmm.
However, if I say this, depending on how well we were taught to swim, will determine how, whether or not we'll be able to sink or swim, right? So the variable here is preparation. And Rabbi Akiva said, look, learn how to swim. And I have always said, if you go out on a date with somebody, you know, which I tell young people all the time, one of the things you should discuss is, God forbid, low later, what would happen? How would you, you know, it's okay to say, well, one of our children fell overboard, and our neighbor's child fell overboard, and our dog fell overboard. Who would you save first? Well, that game we can play, right? But if I say, what would you do if Chas v'Shalom, lo aleinu, your child was born with some form of a disability?
Mm-hmm.
Not judging the person that you're sitting across from, but to understand where they're coming from. How were they prepared? Because what often happens in a marriage is when a child is born, something unusual happens that we didn't cover during the dating period. And I might add that the dating process in the firm world is one that is not fraught with movies and going out to eat and, you know, filling time with entertainment value, but but it's a process whereby you can sit 8 to 10 hours with somebody across from them and talk for 8 to 10 hours straight. And the second date could last 12 hours. And if there's a third date, usually it could last even longer. And it can often end in, will you marry me? 3 days.
Right.
Because in those 3 dates, the people that are sitting across from each other are going deeply into the variables of life. And they're questioning, and they're sharing where they came from, how they got there, who's important, who was significant to them,
Okay, so, Eliza, can I interject? In my first 3 dates with my wife, I guess by worldly standards, it'd be considered very boring get-togethers. We met at a mutual friend's house, and we sat there for an hour and a half, and then we had another hour and a half at a local hotel in Sfax, and then our third date, which sealed for me, we went to a cafe in Tiberias, by the Kinneret, where we drank Coca-Cola and ate some chips, and we talked for a couple hours. We took a bus ride, and after sharing our values for probably about 6, maybe close to 7 hours. I came to a decision that I felt this was the woman I wanted to marry. And 25 plus years later, I'm glad I made that choice.
You think it's going to work out?
I'm looking forward to the next
25. Okay, so anyhow,
look,
usually we can look at family around us and we can come to a conclusion that look, this is what Hashem wants, right?
Right.
And we eventually accept it and move forward. But how do you know that the person sitting across from you is going to feel the same way unless you have that discussion? Certainly no one
davens
for a child with Chas v'Shalom with a disability of any kind. But when the situation arises, you want to be prepared. And you don't want any surprises, especially from your spouse. Mom could be in the hospital after having delivered a baby, and the husband walks in, and all of a sudden, he's talking about something that is not even within her realm of consciousness. You know, it's not even within her realm of potential. So these are things that need to be discussed, and they should always be discussed as much as possible. And my favorite... My favorite phrase is, everything Hashem created was made with its own limit, simultaneously with a specific intent. And what's the only creation capable of work that has no limit? It's our nefesh elokis, because that's the part that's connected with Hashem, which is truly unlimited. And as a result of that... as a result of that connection, the soul is granted unbounded powers, and man's true dignity and sanctity comes from his ability to have to be in the presence of Hashem. So humanness consists of a capacity for a relationship with God, and that's the bottom line. I mean, if you have a good relationship with God, and you have a good relationship with your spouse, and you have a good relationship with your family and your in-laws and your children, your offspring, then the child, will become part of the human process of having this beautiful relationship. And if not, then you have to ask yourself, what's the minimum level of intelligence to be a Jew?
Eliza, we have about 16 minutes to go. I know that you wanted to share some insights about this day of redemption for the first Chabad Rebbe, and how that applies to our days as well.
I was going to talk a little bit about it's. I have much more than 16 minutes here, so I think I'm going to just do a brief overview that the Shabbos descended on the city of Lubavitch. The Hasidim studied for an hour and a half before Kabbalah Shabbos, it was announced that the Rebbe Rashab's letter would be read. With measured steps, the Rebbe's son, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, walked over to the podium, and everyone rose. Silence reigned as the only sound heard was the rustling of the pages of the letter. Sorry, couldn't resist. Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak began reading aloud. My children, may you live, and the loving voice of the Father could be heard throughout the hall. Afterwards, all the students began to sing. The melody poured forth sweetly. Later that evening, the elder chassid, Rabbi Dov Zev, related the story of the arrest and the liberation of the Alter Rebbe. Perhaps next week we could even get into that, discuss the details of that a little more, because we just don't have enough time today. Right. So in vivid tones, he described the pain of the Hasidim when the Rebbe was taken from them. He recounted the entire story up until the release of the Alter Rebbe from jail. And he described the Hasidim somersaulting in the snowy streets of Petersburg. What's Petersburg called? There's another word for Petersburg today.
Would it be Moscow
Leningrad.
Today? Leningrad, I'm sorry.
And their tremendous joy. Afterwards, an old chassid by the name of Rabbi Shmuel Bezalel stood up and inspired the multitude with his heartfelt and fiery words of connection to the Rebbe. Rabbi Shmuel Bezalel raised a cup for a l'chaim, and his voice shook with emotion. The students gazed upon him, always in awe, for he had merited to see the Tzemach Tzedek, the third Lubavitcher Rebbe. The meal began, a royal feast befitting the Rosh Hashanah of Hasidim, which is Yud Tes Kislev. At the end of the meal, all davened, all danced, everybody danced. At 3 a.m., Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak blessed all of those present and was accompanied home with great love. So Yud Tes Kislev has an amazing... let's see if I can say a little bit more about it here. The Hasidic movement grew in popularity and expanded opposition to its teachings and practices increased as it expanded. Particularly in the scholarly circles of Lithuania, opposition became fierce and eventually involved the secular authorities. Some of the leaders of Hasidim even left for the Holy Land. Rabbi Shneur Zalman, the Alter Rebbe of Liadi, prepared to do likewise, but instead returned to Lithuania to spread the Baal Shem Tov's doctrines there. He could have run away. The battle continued over the next 20 years. After the passing of the saintly Gaon of Vilna, the strongest opposition figure, strife erupted again, more fiercely than ever. This time, the focus was Rabbi Shneur Zalman, due in part to the great strength of the movement, had gathered under his leadership. But perhaps the strongest reason for the violent feelings was the publication of his seminal work called the Tanya. A special committee was formed with the express purpose of destroying Hasidism. It was decided to use the power of the central government of Petersburg to this end, and the Rebbe was accused of treason. Since the Rebbe had established a fund for aiding the indigent in the Holy Land, which was then under the sovereignty of Turkey, and an enemy of Russia, some things never change, the opposition accused him of dispersing funds to a foreign power. They also added the charge that in his teachings, he denigrated the importance of kingship. Rabbi Shneur Zalman was arrested and driven to the dreaded Black Mary, a special vehicle reserved for transport of the worst criminals to the frightful fortress of Petrovlasov. Petropavlovsk, where he was detained. Some of these words are really special, huh? He was detained for 52 days. He was endlessly interrogated regarding the charges and the other and other matters of the Jewish faith, in which the government interested itself. The interrogators were greatly impressed by the strength of Rabbi Shneur Zalman, who preserved his composure in the most trying of circumstances and answered their inquiries with extraordinary wisdom. Even in matters totally divorced from the trial proceedings, the Gentile prison officials were able to see the great saintliness of their prisoner. Once the Rebbe was interred in a room which was pitch black, as dark in the day as it was in the night. His only source of light was a small lamp. One day, at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the Rebbe was told that the time was already past midnight and he should go to sleep. "Right now," the Rebbe retorted, "the time is 2 hours and 5 minutes past noon." Astonished, the jailers asked him how he could possibly know that, to which he replied, "Every day is illuminated by 12 forms of the letters of the ineffable name of the Tetragram, the name of Hashem, while the night is illuminated by the 12 forms of the name denoting Hashem's lordship. By experiencing these various forms, I know how to distinguish between day and night and between 1 hour and the next." During the term of the Rebbe's imprisonment, the chief of police had discussed the case with the Tsar, telling him that he perceived the prisoner to be a saintly individual who was the victim of false charges stemming from jealousy and hatred. The Tsar became curious to meet such an extraordinary person and decided to draw his own conclusions. He disguised himself as an ordinary clerk of the court and went to see the Rebbe for himself. But as soon as he entered the cell, the Rebbe rose and uttered the blessing for which we cite before royalty. In other words, he made the bracha over seeing the king. The disguised Tsar asked him in surprise why he stood and appeared to accord him such honor, as he was a mere clerk. The Rebbe replied, "For you must be the Tsar. Our sages teach that the sovereignty on earth is similar to the sovereignty in the heavens. Just as the fear of Hashem is great, so too did I experience an unusual sense of awe when you entered, such as I have never felt before any other official. I therefore concluded you must be the Tsar." The Tsar left convinced that of both his saintliness and innocence. Throughout the terrible ordeal, the Rebbe never doubted his salvation. When the time came for the Rebbe to be brought to court for an important interrogation, he was led from his underground cell out into the cold night air. He was seated on the deck of a ferry, which was to bring him across the river to the imperial court. The Rebbe suddenly saw emerging from behind a cloud the sliver of the new moon.
Eliezer, I hate to interrupt you. We're actually coming to the, believe it or not, we're coming to the end, 5 minutes. We're going to have to make this part one, and next week will be part two of the presentation, because I have to take care of a business matter.
Okay, remind me that we're up to Kiddush Levana.
Okay, Kiddush Levana. So can you give a one-minute wind-down first? Thank you for sharing one of your most valuable resources, your precious time. How can people connect to Heart to Heart and support your noble efforts and that of your wife of Ella Chana Tova?
Well, first of all, I want to thank everybody who already has, and then anybody who would like to participate at this time of the year. Hanukkah, of course, is a great opportunity to give and bring light at the same time. And, of course, tzedakah is equal to, by itself, is equal to all the other mitzvahs, just that one act. So if you want to participate, it's very simple. You mail a check to Heart to Heart, 383 Kingston Avenue, Suite 232, Brooklyn, New York, 11213. Or you can go to our website, hearttoheartamerican.org, click, go through the website and click on the donation page. Or you can go to the new website, which will be up and running, I'm told, very shortly. We apparently, Yahoo finally got their act together.
Yahoo!
Yahoo! So we have Heart to Heart AJSTC, which is the Associated Jerusalem Society for Distinguished Children, AJSTC.org. And you can also go to hearttoheartajstc.com. You can call Don Zusha Goodman, New York, if you want to talk to him directly at 347-something-something-something.
347-613-4615, 347-613-4615. I don't take voice messages, blessed souls, but I do take text messages. With that being said, we're going to end off today's program. Again, thanking profusely Rabbi Dr. Eliyahu Goldtech, international human rights activist, for coming on today's program. We're going to end off with a song which is intimately connected to tomorrow night's celebration, commemoration of the liberation of the first Chabad Rebbe of Shneur Zalman of Liadi. It's called Parav Shalom. Although the song is sang in Hebrew, I'm going to read the words, which are the lyrics to the song, and then you can listen to the beautiful melody, which was recorded probably close to 40 years ago, but in its pristine purity, you can hear the contemporary longing for those who sang it 40 years ago. This song was composed many, many years ago, before 40 years ago, and based on the lyrics of the King, Prophet King David, chapter 55, verse 19, he redeemed my soul in peace from battles drawing near me for the sake of the masses who are with me. May God hear and answer them. He was enthroned from days of old Salah. Again, those who ignore their own demise and fear not God. He stretched out his hands against his peaceful ones. He profaned his covenant. Smoother than butter were the words of his mouth, but his heart was at war. This is talking about people who were treacherous to King David. His words were softer than oil, yet they were curses. Cast your burden upon Hashem, your burden. Let me just get to that last. And he will sustain you. He will never fall. He will never allow the faltering of the righteous. But you, God, shall love them into the... But you, God, shall lower them, those men of deceit, into the well of destruction. Men of bloodshed and deceit shall not live out half their days. But as for me, I will trust in you. And may this transparent way of Ahavachad, one love, girl, one destiny, for all of us, in a pleasant, peaceful way. Take care, everyone.